Our world is magical. Games are magical. Open your eyes and prepare to discover how magic and games intersect.
Merry meet, and welcome to Covenstead, a podcast about gaming and magic.
A lone man, struggling against his past. He must fight for his loved ones. Fight for his reputation, and fight everyone else in the world.
Action movies, and action games,
Woo!
And action.
There we go.
Action.
Nice 1980s style narration going there. I like it. I like it very yes. much.
We all know within 5 minutes, the wife dies, the daughter dies, boss dies.
Somebody gets fridged. Someone's puppy gets killed.
Yes.
Everybody.
Yep.
My son was commenting. My son was commenting the other day. He was saying, it's just like, you know, I can't remember what movie, but he caught on YouTube like a really old movie trailer. And it's just like, and there was a guy doing narration in the trailer. And I'm just like, oh, yeah, that was the guy.
There was a guy.
And that was his job. And that's what he was known for.
LaFontaine! Then, I even know his name, Don LaFontaine.
Yes, there we go. Shout out to Don LaFontaine, who hopefully is still alive.
No, R.I.P.
No, he is.
R.I.P.
Okay, all right. Yep. This episode has just become dedicated in
dedicated to Don LaFontaine.
There we go.
In a world. Perfect. In a world where nothing makes sense.
Yes,
justice
that's right.
Makes sense. Justice.
In a world where a podcast has gone silent for far too long, eventually, from the ashes, comes Covenstead.
Yes! So, yes, everybody, welcome back to Covenstead. You know, the podcast of gaming and magic. Today, we're going to be focusing on gaming and specifically action games. I'm Danny, and with me is...
Todd the Interrupter.
Todd the Interrupter. It's Todd, and we're going to talk about, like I said, this focus on gaming today, and we're going to talk about action games and how do we run an action game? What makes an action game? How do you do that in the theater of the mind? You know, like, you know, action movie, you can see it, you can watch it, you know, you can hear it. And, you know, so how do we do that? How do we get that feeling, you know, of like leaping with both guns blazing through the doorway and just, you know, hammering on the bad guys? How do we give our players that feeling? I personally love action and horror are my two, you know, they're my top genres. You know, there are two things you can always get me to watch: horror and action. So I have a plethora of movies and games and things that, so I am excited. I have a library of action movies in my brain, so I'm excited to start talking about it and figuring out how we can get those feelings, you know. How do you feel about action?
I love it. I think it's definitely, action films are my definite guilty pleasure. And even then too, when you and I were last chatting and we started talking about what do we want to talk about for our first episode back from the break, and action films came up, and it, you know, within seconds we started talking about the new Roadhouse and gushing about it, and about the original and about the remake. And, you know, people who we know who love it and people who we know who didn't love it and all this other kind of stuff. Action films are something that I have a really deep respect for. When I went to film school, so many years ago, it was specifically because I wanted to make action films. It's not just watching them where it's just like, oh, it's really cool. It's really exciting. It's not even a thing where it's just like, oh, I'm such a fan of the violence. It's the craft of making them and the precision that goes into it and the care and, you know, like just the minute detail that has to go into things that happen at a rapid fire pace. And when it's done right, it's amazing. And For me, my tastes in action have very much changed over the years. Like, I've been going back. Oh, yeah. So, like, in the 80s, you know, a teenage boy, it was all about Stallone and Schwarzenegger. And so...
Yes! Some of my favorites. Predator, Commando, First Blood, Rambo. I can go on. See, the thing with me is my dad, my parents divorced when I was 10. And I lived with my dad. So my dad, my taste in movies was what my dad was watching, which was Jean-Claude Van Damme, Steven Seagal, you know, Stallone, Schwarzenegger, Bruce Willis, you know, like all that, you know what I mean? I mean, I grew up on Die Hard as a Christmas movie, you know, like,
yeah,
you know, it is. No one can tell me any different. So please don't give us comments because you cannot convince me otherwise. It is a Christmas movie. It's about a man discovering the meaning of family.
Yeah.
At Christmas and reuniting with his family, and it's a beautiful story. And that's, you know.
and a building blows up. So there you've got like your bonfire, you know, you're roasting chestnuts, the terrorists are the roasting chestnuts, you know.
Yeah. There's gifts, you know, flying out of windows, everything. Yeah, it's great.
I agree to that. Yeah, I agree to that, so long as you also agree that Lethal Weapon 1 is also a Christmas movie.
Absolutely.
Based on the premise that there is a shootout in a Christmas tree lot. Boom.
Look.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I'm with you. We can agree on that. No convincing here. I'm with you on that hill. I'm with you. But you were saying your taste changed from the 80s, too.
Yeah. So in the 80s, it was very much gratuitous violence. It was all about the body count. And even then, too, there's some great documentaries out there now about Arnold Schwarzenegger and Sylvester Stallone, both of them on Netflix, I believe. And they do talk about that, and that they had this competition going, and is that it had to be about bigger guns, bigger muscles, higher body counts, all this other kind of stuff. The more, the merrier. The hero never faltered. The hero never fell. And it was all about the only way to right a wrong is through murder. You know, however you wanted to look at it, whoever got fridged, you know, like you said before, the wife, the child, the dog, the mom, the dad, the uncle, whatever the case may be, the captain of the police force who is 5 days away from retirement, doesn't matter. Murder was okay in a 1980s action film. The ones that I enjoy nowadays either overtly have a message that's actually anti-violence by using violence, in that they are very gratuitous in the sense where it's just like, oh, I wouldn't want to be in that fight. That's fucked up. You know what I mean? You know, someone walks away and they're still like, they're missing a finger. Like the hero is missing a finger or missing several teeth. Like they're scarred for life, kind of stuff like that.
Right.
You know, or the ones where they're maybe a little more subtle, and you know, like there are some, like there's a movie Nobody with
love that one, Bob Odenkirk.
There we go.
That's such a good movie.
Yes, the ending of it, I was a little disappointed by the end of it, because in the end of it, it just kind of seemed like violence is great. Whooping, two thumbs up, and then everything is fine, and it all kind of works itself out, you know, and stuff like that.
Right.
Because the hero is not as violent as the villain in this bizarre, twisted way, and that's what makes it okay. So, and in that sense, I kind of wish that it was like, well, you know, and like I said, maybe that's just because the way things in my life have been going have definitely gone on the dark and grim route, that I'm just like, no, I think it would be good if he were to, you know, you can have the same ending, but he doesn't get his family back. You know, where it's like his wife is just like, no, you lied to me all these years. Then he takes off and he realizes the only thing that he's good for is killing terrible people, you know, whatever the case may be. I think that's one of the reasons why the John Wick films really scratch the itch for me nowadays, is because he loses everything because he gives in to the violent urges, you know? He doesn't lose his wife because of it. I think it was a nice twist of they found a unique way to really get people on board with the mayhem, and that he killed a puppy. Someone killed a puppy. And that's the line. Okay, that's it. These motherfuckers got to go. You could do whatever.
And that was like the cutest dog in the world, too. That dog was so cute. Oh my gosh. Yeah. And then everybody, because I like to watch reactions to movies, especially action movies and really good movies that I love, to see people watching it for the first time. And literally every time I've seen a reaction to John Wick, as soon as the dog dies, everybody's like, kill him. They have to die. Make it slow. You know, it's just they have to die, but they want them to suffer.
Yeah. There's so many times where as soon as a dog appears, especially in an action film, it's like, oh no, not the dog. Not the dog. But it works so well because you know that you needed that to happen because that's what actually spearheads everything else. But then once he decides to not turn the other cheek and to embrace his violent past and return to it, he eventually loses the car that he loves. He loses his house. He loses his standing within like the assassin community. Like, you know, he loses his privileges at the Continental, friendships, you know, everything like that. He just like he burns it all to the ground in so many ways. And in a sense, he doesn't even burn it all down to the ground. He basically just keeps going until he can't go anymore. Because even in the end of John Wick 4, it's not
spoilers if no one's seen it yet, but
yeah, you know what? Suffice it to say,
it's
we're
been
talking
enough
about
time.
Yeah. Hopefully nothing is getting spoiled. If it is, well, you know what? Now you know how I felt when they decided for the final Avengers movie to do a commercial where all the best scenes were in the damn commercial.
Oh,
it was nothing but spoilers. Captain America catching Mjolnir and stuff like that. All of it was in this one commercial. So yeah, there's.
Oh my gosh.
But with the John Wick films, like by the end of John Wick 4, it's not even like the High Table is demolished, never to be risen again. It still exists, you know. And even then too, it's just like, oh okay, the person in charge, well, they get replaced. But the High Table still exists. This entire underworld community is still a thing. He just keeps going until he can't kill anybody else anymore. He's been just so shot and beat up that he just has to stop. And it's like, okay, there, good enough. I did what I could. And then he just dies.
Right.
You know what I mean? And so in that sense, those are the kind of, it's an odd line to walk, but for me, it's action movies that really kind of show that violence, you know, to these characters is a necessary thing, if you will. But at the same time, too, it doesn't sugarcoat it and say, like, isn't war fun? Isn't it awesome? Shouldn't you, especially when you have this really blurry line nowadays, this realization when it comes to mass shootings and everything else like this. You know, like you look back on so many action films where there's a shooting in a club and then you kind of look at the news and going like, gee, I wonder how we got from there to here, you know, kind of a situation. But to me, it's just an indication of just how deep a good action film can really get.
Right.
You know, that it's not just window dressing and surface coatings and everything like that.
It reminds me of, have you seen the Equalizer series with Denzel Washington?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That's a good example. Here's this guy who just wants his life. Read his 100 books. You know, he was a CIA operative. You know, he did all this stuff. Now he just wanted to live with his wife and read his books and do all this stuff. But then he sees somebody in trouble, you know, and he uses his skills to help that person, you know, and the other movies are like the same thing until the final Equalizer, where he finally settles in Italy and decides this is where I want to be. And he's like the protector of the town. You know, he doesn't want to be. And the thing about Denzel Washington's character, Robert McCall, is that he always gives them the opportunity to walk away.
Yeah.
Yeah. He says, here, take this money and give me the girl that he was friends with. Take this money. I'm giving you $1,800. Give me the girl, and that'll be the end of it. And then they say no. So, well, now we have a problem. You know what I mean? Like, and he doesn't kill anybody. Like, he's broken arms and legs and stuff like that. But in those movies, he's at a point in his life where he doesn't want to do that if he doesn't have to. You know what I mean? Like, and it's one of those, like, his skills come in useful to protect people who can't protect themselves. But it makes it very clear that he will try any other method he can. He will pay you. He will ask you to stop. He will give you another option. And if you don't take those, like, bad guys don't, you know, like, they don't, then we get violent. But that's a good example of what you're talking about, of, like, the guy who doesn't want to do it anymore.
Yeah.
But has these skills, you know?
Even then, by the beginning of Equalizer 3, he's reached this point where his own violence has kind of crescendoed into this level of brutality that didn't exist. It was actually kind of quite shocking to me, because when I went to see the Equalizer 3 in the theaters, I had just watched 1 and 2 before. And then to see how 3 started, you know, with the amount of bloodshed and brutality and stuff like this, was quite a shift. That I actually wondered if it was a different director, and it's not. It's Antoine Fuqua the entire way.
Yeah.
But that just goes to show that he had reached this point where he was just now starting to do it so much and so often that he was starting to become numb to it. But also, too, he wanted somebody to stop him and put him out of it. He
wasn't
finding that same purpose anymore. He was starting to slip. And yeah, it's that kind of stuff. You know, the psychological scarring that comes with it. Whether or not it's a film like Nobody, where it's about somebody, you know, like, with a unique set of skills, to use the famous quote, you know, who tries to repress it for so long, but then eventually kind of gets dragged back into the fold, versus somebody who just gets way too deep into the muck.
Right.
And is literally drowning in the blood that they've shed.
Yeah, because Liam Neeson's character in Taken that you quoted was, you know, he was there, he was trying to be a good dad, do all this stuff. They took his daughter. And when he talked to them, he just was like, hey, return her. I won't look for you. I won't whatever, you know. But you should know that if you don't, here's what's going to happen. And the guy was just like, good luck. And well, then, you know, here we go, you know.
Yeah.
But he did try to say, like, hey, just return her. Just give her back. And I won't look for you. I won't cause any problems. We won't discuss it ever again. You know, any of this stuff. But, you know, yeah, so, you know, those, you know, and then the favorite pastime of action fans, you know, who could beat and win in a fight, John Wick, The Equalizer, Liam Neeson's character, Nobody, Jason Bourne, you know, like, you know, who's gonna come out on top, you know? But I think this brings us into the next
audience.
Topic.
The, yeah, audience, the audience, that's who's going to win.
Right. But this brings me into, like, the question, now that we've kind of talked about, you know, action movies in general, you know, why do we like them? I guess that's my question, because if we have to understand that if we're going to talk about games and then bring, you know, we want to play an action RPG.
Yeah.
How do we recreate those feelings? So I feel like in order to do that, from my perspective, we have to sit there and think, well, what do we like about them? Why do we like action movies? You know, why? You know, why are they something that we hold on to? And there's lots of reasons. I don't think there's just one. I like them because, you know, I enjoy watching competent people. So watching people competent in battle and, you know, justice, they're usually all about justice and getting, you know, some sort of satisfaction in taking back power in a world where you might feel powerless, you know, like there are these people who actually have abilities that can, you know, take some of that power back, you know, and give it to people who really need it, you know, or, you know, and punish people who need to be punished, you know. So I think that's some of it. I mean, what about you? You know, I mean.
Yeah, for me, I mean, there's definitely some of that. For me, it's the escapism of it, because no matter how realistic or gritty or over the top or anything action can be, there is an incredible amount of fictionalization that goes into the action, no matter what, because it's a very controlled burst of mayhem. And this was something I thought a lot about when I was working on my game High Plains Samurai 5+ years ago. Mm-hmm. Because that was one where that one's definitely, it's an action game through and through. It's a game where these are characters who use violence to accomplish their goals. Enough said. Mm-hmm. But it's very much kind of over the top, you know, what I call wire foo violence. The idea was just like, nah, gravity's optional. You know, no matter what kind of character you have, it's quite possible that, you know, anyone can balance on the end of a tree branch easily, you know.
Yeah, so we're talking like Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon.
Boom, so. Exactly. And then merging that together with samurai gangsters, barbarians, gunslingers, and steampunk in a world full of superpowers that also has wire foo. The idea of being anything and everything is open, it's on the table. And when I started really kind of trying to figure out, because action films for me were something, I just watched them, I just enjoyed it. You know, I didn't think about it. If I did, it was more of like the filmmaking technique, the recognition of the stunt work that went into it, very behind the scenes kind of stuff. But otherwise, I could just watch it and just not care anything about it and not get into these, you know, very, you know, academic discussions about, you know, like, well, what I found for me that what the John Wick films did was, you know, it was just like, was that good? Fucking A, it was good. You know, that's more. But when I really started taking a look at it, and especially too, because at the time I was very much into, you know, some of the martial arts films that were coming out of, you know, parts that a lot of people I don't think of when you think of martial arts films. And I'm thinking more specifically about Vietnam, Indonesia, Southeast, even too. Like, you know, like.
Okay, you want to talk about
Pakistan have a lot of action films lately. Yeah.
Start talking about stuff like The Night Comes for Us. Have you seen that one? Or The Raid?
Yes.
Or any of the Raid. Holy, wow.
Best action film of all time, and I will die on this hill, is The Raid.
It was so good. Like, how?
Yes.
How did they do some of that stuff? So, yeah, and just going back a quick, like, tangent aside, let's get some Oscars for stunt people. Let's have an Oscar category for stunt people. Like,
yes.
You know, they put their bodies on the line, their lives on the line for this movie that you should enjoy. Like, they deserve to have recognition for some physical feat that they pulled off that looked amazing on screen.
Absolutely.
That's my tangent.
Absolutely. Oh, absolutely.
Oscar category.
Agree 100%. The amount of work that goes into this. I've met a couple of professional stunt people in my year.
Oh, cool. Okay.
And the amount of, it's not even just the case of just like, yeah, you know, they hired me for this movie and I'm supposed to jump over a car. You know, no biggie, you know. It is what it is. You do what you got to do. It's not just that. It's the fact of like, okay, well, now you have to have a matching body type to the person to the actor that you're representing in this. So like in Hard Target, there is a scene where Van Damme's character, and first of all, let me just say that Hard Target has one of the best premises for a hero, which is basically he's doing all this because he needs to make $217, you know, so that he can get his fishing license so that he can go get a job. You know, that's why. And then explosions ensue and he kills professional killers. And
for $217?
$117.
Oh, yeah.
But there is a scene where his character basically he's riding a motorcycle directly at an oncoming car, smashes into that car and goes over top of the car, lands on the other side, shoots out the back of the car, and because it's the 90s, the car explodes. That stunt person actually had to do it. Actually had to. There had to be enough momentum to at least propel them so that when they struck the car, that they at least vaulted over enough. And yes, you cut it 5 or 6 times. Not like Taken, where it takes 30 cuts to have a guy jump a fence. That's another topic unto its own. There's a tangent right there. But with enough momentum to basically start hurling over the car. And not only did he have to train to do that and practice, and all the logistics have to be worked out, but he's also got to have a body type that matches that of Jean-Claude Van Damme, who is a professional bodybuilder, you know, in addition to a martial artist. He didn't just look that way. He was specific. He sculpted himself to look like that at that age. So, you know, like the amount of detail that has to go into every minutia of pulling off these stunts. Yes, you know, like that, it's like modern day dancing. If they were just like, you know, if you had fake bullets flying, look at a John Woo film, or at least some of his earlier work in the 90s and everything else like that. The choreography, the cinematography that went into it, the slow motion effect with it, you know, and everything like that. You know, he finds a way of incorporating this beauty into all of this violence in a way that is, you know, if you stop and think about it, it is both beautiful and disturbing. I'm just like, wow, why do I feel so pleased, you know, to see such destruction? If this happened in my house, I'd be weeping, you know.
Hey, so those are some good things of like, you know, we want, you know, justice to prevail. We want escapism.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's also like the benefit. I mean, we watch movies to escape. But I think genres like the action genre, you know, there are movies that sit there and make you think, you know, they make you ponder, they make you, you know, sit there and look at morality and they make you kind of question, and they're this experience. And action movies, I think another reason that people like them is because they are simple. Good is good, bad is bad. And I think, you know, I think those are the things we need to create if we're going to run a game in an action setting, right? We need to recreate the idea of, what I'm doing is justified, you know, what, you know, looking cool and the escapism and stuff like that. You know, that's what we have to recreate in our minds if we're going to run an action game, you know?
Right. Now, the main thing that I found and still find to this day, in that one of the areas where I find action role-playing games tend to stutter when it comes to, you know, replicating action films. I mean, because for the most part, yes, you can have action books, you know, like military books and other kind of stuff like this, you know, but really for the most part, when people think action, they think cinema, you know. There's no action, you know. I don't think Fast and Furious is coming to an off-Broadway show anytime soon. And if it does, kudos to them for trying. They did try Spider-Man, but anyways. So you're normally thinking of action films. And in those cases, like you were saying, competency is the expectation. The main character or characters are highly competent at what they do. Them failing at the task is not a question. And in that sense, role-playing games kind of sputter when it comes to that, because they are almost always built with failure mechanics, with risks of failure, mostly uncontrollable risks of failure, because you are rolling dice. You're basically rolling a polyhedral device with a random series of numbers on it and hoping some of those numbers come up in your favor. And so in that sense, that's kind of one of the areas where, you know, that can be a little dicey, where in my own personal experience, trying to convert some films. Yeah.
Sorry, a little dicey.
Pun intended and unintended. Subconsciously, I'm sure I was cackling.
But I'll bump.
But it is one of those things where it's just like, you know, if you're specific. So one of the things that I tried to do, like so many other people at the time, was to create a Matrix RPG, which has still not been done in a published way. There's a guy I knew, Trey Grisby, and he had worked on one. And his was really interesting because he really kind of understood a lot of the nuances of what the Wachowskis were trying to do, you know, like kind of in addition to not just the fact is just like, oh, this represents that and everything else like this. But one of the main issues that I was constantly running into was the sense of just like, in the films, you have these characters that are so incredibly competent, they even know what's going on behind them. Like, the beauty of the Matrix films is that it solved the equation of, it's just like, how did he know that someone was coming up behind him so that he could do a backward spin kick and take him out before the guy could even swing a punch. And the Matrix film solved that. And it's just like, well, it's all coded, you know? And it's just like, genius. It was just brilliant how it just solved that problem. But to trying to replicate an action film where there is a risk of failure, because, you know, like most games, at their baseline, they have, and I think we've talked about it on the show here before, they have what I call the 50% plus one factor, which is basically no modifications or anything whatsoever. You have a 50% chance plus one of success without leveling up or, you know, like any other competencies that come over the course of the game. Having that as the standard in role-playing games for an action genre that demands competency can be quite problematic. And that is an area where I think that's where it tends to start the most, especially when you're trying to take films, you know, or film universe or anything like that, and adapt it into, you know, a role-playing game. If you have something that is a role-playing game that only exists as such, then it totally works, because the role-playing game is what's setting the expectation. You're not getting this expectation. It's like the first time I played the D20 Star Wars game, and I was playing a Jedi, and I got shot. And I'm like, right away, broke the veil for me right then and there. Just like, hold on a second now. I'm a Jedi. That's supposed to be a major feat for me to get shot. And we just got started. And it's just like, oh, what can you do? You know, it's just the mechanics of the game. And that is the part where it's like, it can be very tricky when it comes to action. And so you have to find ways in your games to kind of overcompensate and kind of adjust for that. It's like, you're not going to be as competent as the heroes in the film. That's my big ultimate hot take when it comes to action and RPGs.
Well, I think there's a good example that we can talk about, that where a trope was used, that trope was used to great effect for both an action and horror movie. One of my favorites, and I'm sure one of your favorites too, Predator.
Yes.
Predator. What made Predator good was that right from the beginning, we got a good sense that these guys are competent. Okay, they're huge, they're mercenaries, they know what they're doing, they go in and they take out these gorillas. You know, we watch them in action, we watch how they work together, we watch how good they are at what they do in the first part of the film. And how they use that action trope, because the first part was basically an action movie. You know, like the first part, basically. And then they use that trope of like, these are super competent people, action heroes. They use that to bring in the horror. What if there's something that they're afraid of, right? So the Predator, you know? And so it's interesting that that's so true of the action genre. Like, these guys are competent, right? And I think Bruce Willis kind of broke the mold when he did Die Hard, because I think that was one of the first times where we kind of saw an action hero who was getting beat up and who was getting the crap kicked out of him. You know, he was smart and he was competent, but he didn't always win, right? Yeah. He got messed up and he screwed up, you know, like, and so, you know, how do you take that and get that feel? You know what I mean? Like, how do you get that feel in a game, right? How do you get that action feel? And I think you're right. You have to kind of accept that it's not going to be, you know, 100%. You know, so you might be shooting something for more along the lines of Bruce Willis, you know, kind of thing in Die Hard rather than a Stallone or, you know, Schwarzenegger or something like that.
Right. Yeah. That's what the whole concept of feeling forward that is, you know, really become popular in a lot of storytelling games nowadays, I think really applies in a really good action game, in the sense where it's just like, you know, failing at a role, and I'm going to use failing in air quotes here, but failing at a role does not necessarily mean that you screwed up. What it means is, well, the situation has got a little bit more complicated. But it's a complication that you can find a way to overcome, whether or not you find a way to remove it entirely, or you just have to work your way around it. And that was one of the two solutions I ended up coming up with for High Plains Samurai, was the idea of incorporating failing forward, where it's like, okay, there needs to be times where it's like, they can't be super competent. There are going to be moments where you just kind of let the players chew the scenery. You know, it's like, let them shine. Let them be the most awesome one in the room. You know, it's only when they're trying to force something onto another character. So if you go to shoot somebody else, well, that person doesn't want you to shoot them. And so in that sense, you now trigger the dice roll because they don't want to get shot, but you want to shoot them. What a conundrum. So
Yeah, right.
And what it does is in that game is that you're actually rolling to determine whether or not the action happens exactly as intended and who gets to determine the outcome, the person who is shooting or the person getting shot. And in that sense, it's basically, it's a writer's table game. The mechanics are actually saying, okay, Danny, I rolled against your character, but because of the results of the roll, you get to determine how this plays out. But it has to be framed in the sense where it's like, I did shoot your character, but how I shot your character is up to you. Whereas if I have rolled in a certain way, I get to determine it. And so obviously, because I'm the big shot, I want to have it go with the way that I specifically wanted it to. But in that sense where it's just like, damn, I can't necessarily do damage all the time. So I'm going to create these complications that basically say it's like, okay, you can no longer just charge directly at the character. That doesn't mean you can't reach the character, but you can't just charge forward. You got to find some other way of doing it. It's about creating failing forward opportunities. I think that's an area that action games can really make a lot of use out of because they that's true. Yeah, they really force you to think outside of the box. And I think that's one of the areas where
games, and it's not like, we don't see it in action movies. Like that's
you see it all the time.
Oh, here's a board. The hero picks it up randomly, you know, because it's there. And you know, improv. Now we're hitting because his gun got tossed away somehow in the fight. So now he has no weapon. So now we got to grab something and we got to work with it. You know, like that's a staple. You know.
Yeah. Exactly. I think that's one of the reasons why it's so difficult for me to actually really be able to get into D&D anymore is because there isn't, unless it's something that the DM is bringing in themselves, there's nothing that makes it an integral part of the game where failing forward is incorporated into it, where it's just like, ah, I failed the roll. Well, I guess I'm done. Next. You know, versus, you know, and I have had some DMs who find ways to incorporate that in there. It's just like, okay, you know, so instead what's going to happen now is you've now dropped your sword and it's actually just fallen down this little ledge. You could get it, but if you go to get it, that's going to take up like your action on the next turn. So that gives you the choice to basically say is like, do I really need my sword or can I find some other way to deal with this scenario?
Can I just punch this guy in the face instead?
Yeah, you know? Sure you can. 1d2 damage, but he's got 80 hit points.
Damn.
You'll have to do it like at least 40 times at maximum effect.
Who do you think I am, Donnie Yen?
Yeah, exactly. How many punches can I get in a round? Two. At next level, you know? So, yeah, I think it's one of those things where I think embracing the fact that it's like these characters are going to be put into situations where it's not going to go according to plan, and still giving them the opportunity to get there, you know? And in that sense, you know, that's when I find the standard mechanics of role-playing games, like hit points and everything else like that, do work, you know, like in the action genre's favor, for sure.
Yeah. I mean, are there any particular action RPGs? I mean, you wrote one, but are there any other ones that you feel like had a good, you know, sense of action, I guess, or you like the way they handled action scenes, even if it wasn't like an action game, you know?
High Plains Samurai is and you can quote scholars on this as I would like to believe that High Plains Samurai is the only game, and so in that sense, you know, you're all best to just kind of give up. However, if I was not to be a dick about it,
My God.
You know what? Honestly speaking, it's been the ones that have been much more storytelling based. Honestly speaking, Dungeon World has been a really good alternative to D&D that I find does scratch that itch. Mm-hmm. Because, and I mean, one of the most basic ways that it does it is that when you attack, first of all, you know, and it's one of the reasons why I don't really run PBT games too much is because I don't get to run roll dice as the GM. And that is just, you know, so problematic for me. But it's bringing up so many other issues.
I must roll the clackities.
But they have so many dice. What's the point? But it's like one of the clever mechanics that it has in it is that if you do the hack and slash move, which is basically you swing a sword, hack and slash, if you roll a 10 or higher, no problem. You do exactly what you want to do, and all you do is cause damage to your enemy. Anything lower than that, 7 to 9, you'll also get hit by your enemy. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And so in that particular sense, that they kind of then make that the failing forward kind of it. It's just like, yes, and there's the risk. I think that's really the main thing with it, is that it creates this element of risk into it. It's like, okay, I could just go for the straight up hack and slash, but by doing so, I expose myself to the risk of my character being harmed. And if I really fuck up the roll, I really expose them to an even greater amount of harm.
Uh-huh.
And I find that to be a really kind of, it just gives you a reason to kind of think, well, is this what I really want to do? Or is there another way that I could go about doing this without putting myself at risk? Uh-huh. You know, and so Dungeon World, I find, is a really good way. It's a more enjoyable way, regardless of the GM, for me to get uh-huh. the D&D style experience. I also got a kick out of my friend Fraser Ronald's game Nefertiti Overdrive. And I mean, some of that might be a little biased because I was playing with friends, but it was in that game was actually a big inspiration for High Plains Samurai for me. Because in that game, it really comes down to, it's like, you just have to kind of sell what it is that you're doing. You know, like over the top action is not only expected, but it's encouraged, and you get a higher die value when you do. But it was also a way of, there were character types included where you didn't have to be the competent action hero to be effective in the game. And so it allows you to really just like, look, if you can just bullshit the GM, you're good. You know, really, in an essence, you just have to be able to sell your character and their competency. And then the dice will just let you know if it kind of worked out the way you expected or not so much. You know, it's just like, well, you kind of did, but unfortunately, you came up a little short.
Yeah.
And there have been others, but I mean, in general, I find it's like with any film, it depends on the director who's involved. It depends on the crew, the people who are actually running it on the set, you know, and how it's been edited and everything else like that. You put a film in the wrong hands and you end up with something that's kind of like, yeah, it was okay. It was good. You know? So, but in general, I do tend to find that a lot of action-based RPGs all pretty much run the same way. Roll this against a target number, get the target number or higher, roll damage, and blah, blah, blah. And sometimes it's what you get to do in between. What about for yourself, though? Like, what are some ones that have been, like, some good go-tos for you?
Okay, so one I'm going to recommend is utterly not meant to be taken seriously. It is meant to capture that fun of 80s and 90s action movies. It's called Straight to VHS. And it is by Ryan Mellon, Lost Cat Games. It is free that you can find it. And it is meant to capture the premises of like samurai cop, like RoboCop, like any of this other stuff, like you know, alien name, like anything, you know, like the intro to it, a werewolf stalks the mean streets of Miami, but not for much longer. Not if a nun and former prostitute named Gloria Vendetta has anything to say about it. Gloria's cybernetically enhanced buddy in the precinct notices ties between the werewolf and the Yakuza, but why? If only the scientist and retired heavyweight champion, Tucker Smash, could regain his memories. Only he knew the antidote to lycanism, and now the plague spreads. Coming straight to VHS, it's Miami Fuzz. And I tell you, I laughed so hard playing this game, I had to use my inhaler. Like, I could not catch my breath.
This game is so good, I almost died. Now there's a review right there. Yeah.
I mean, it was just so funny. Like, this is the cheesy. This is the cheese, the thing you find in the bargain bin. You know, the thing that's on at 1 a.m., you know, it's that thing that you're playing. And I mean, it just goes through all the tropes. You know, you pick your hero and you get all of the, you know, how they do this is they do successes, double damage. So you can also do the whole, like, oh, the hero gets whatever, and lucky breaks and tough breaks, you know, so lucky breaks are that, you know, that thing where the hero, like, gets up and whatever and everything. And what they really did was give you abilities that really, you know, fit that genre and give you abilities to allow you to do the things that they do in those movies. So if your thing is cheesy 80s with premises that were just looked like they were picked from a bingo ball, you know, like one of those rotund things, someone's in the writer's room and they're just with balls with things written on it and pulling them out, this is the game for you. I mean, we loved it. I mean, we had people walking away from explosions, we had product placements, you know, like look, like, it was just like our product placement was, what was it? We had it was Snickers or Kit Kat or some candy bar. And you know, so I highly recommend that. You know, it's not going to be the seriousness of like other action movies, but if you want something that is that cheesy bargain bin, you know, C+, D- kind of action, you know, Velocipaster, you know, whatever, you know, this is the thing for you. And like I said, it's free. Y'all can look it up. I mean, it's just fantastic. So, this thing is like Chuck Norris punching out Rasputin on the picture of it, you know, like it's just... It is just the funniest thing. And like I said, I laughed so hard playing this, I needed to use my inhaler because I could not handle it. But like, you can get features like badass or batshit crazy, or batteries included, blind master, born wild, brave hearted. You know, these are all just things, bumbling sidekick. You know, you can have a bumbling sidekick, chesty, which is, it's pretty clear why your character's actor or actress was hired. Chesty.
Boobs.
Exactly. Or pecs, whichever. They're not being, you know, misogynistic here.
Yeah, exactly. You know? Boy boobs.
Yeah. And with that one, like, if you take chesty, the gun show, a minor action. Once per act, you take off an article of clothing to get +2 strength for the rest of the scene.
Nice.
Or the talent show, once per act, take off an article of clothing to get +2 charisma.
Yeah.
Or wet t-shirt champ. once per scene, get a token when your clothes get wet due to an existing feature of the scene. I'm telling you, see, you're already laughing. Imagine playing a whole game of this stuff. I could not handle it. I could not handle it. Like, it was so great. So if you love that stuff, I highly recommend this game. Other than that, I'm going to... Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, it makes me think of one that I've heard of. I've never actually played myself, but one called Action Movie World. And in that one, the character that you create is the actor who is playing different characters in different films. So you're actually portraying an actor over the course of their career making different films. And so the playbooks in that one are based on the kind of actor you are. So, you know, like, I don't know all the playbooks and everything like that. But I mean, like, you know, there is the one basically where it's just like, you know, you're the former athlete turned actor. And then there's the thespian. I do remember that one specifically, where you're basically the John Malkovich who for some reason is doing Con Air. You know, it's just like, somebody needed money. Somebody's got gambling problems or a mortgage to pay, you know, and stuff like this. So, you know, like, yeah. So ones like that, yeah, ones that basically really kind of play up on the tropes. And just allow you to just kind of just have fun with it, you know, just like a love letter to the genre. Everything that makes it good, everything that makes it bad, everything that makes it good to be bad, and everything.
Well, that sounds so fun. That sounds really fun. But this one was great. I mean, like I said, I love this because I love those movies. Like in the game we played, we had Dirk Bogarde, who was like a former Merc. And my character was based off Goldie Hawn and Overboard.
Nice.
So she was like this. And she like hung from an air helicopter at one point, you know. And like, you know, it's just, it was so great. And we had like a cyborg martial artist. And we had a character who was based off of Egg Chen from Big Trouble in Little China. You know, we just have nice characters that are all coming together. Like one thing you can take here is called Die Hardly, which a shark bite or a gunshot wound, big deal. At the end of each scene, you heal 1 HP without needing to turn in a token. Look.
Nice.
Yeah, so I highly recommend that one because I love those movies. And this is just anything goes. Like anything goes in this. And our game, our movie, because they really do it like it's a movie. And our movie was called Revenge of the Red Tiger Claw 3, Back in Action. Like, see, I'm just telling you about the game.
Yeah.
So, you know.
Nice.
Yeah. So, you know. So I love it. And I think we've you know, you gotta keep the focus in mind when you're playing an action game, you know, and keep those elements that we've kind of discussed in mind and find ways to either modify what you're doing to bring those things in, like you were saying, like a more, you know, getting them to more competency or figuring out ways that they can maneuver if they quote unquote fail, you know, so that it kind of, they can kind of use that, you know, I think the key to a good action is, I mean, yeah, you know, mechanics and stuff, but I also think the way, you know, the way you handle it, keeping the action in mind is also a big factor that I've kind of realized as we've been talking, like, you know, what are action things? They're basically visual. So you have to come up with ways to give your players good visuals so they can visualize that thing going on. You know, give them cool, interesting things to visualize that are action related. You know, leaping out of a plane on, a flotation device, you know, a la Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom when they had the big raft that they went out of the plane with, you know.
Yeah.
Find ways to give them things like that to visualize, interesting things to visualize, will make it feel, I think, very action-y for them. I think.
Yeah, Yeah, and visualization is very much a key to all of it. It makes me think the last time I ran High Plains Samurai specifically, actually, one of the players was Jacob, who is blind. And I thought on a whim of just be like, well, wouldn't it be neat if we actually framed this as more of a radio drama versus more traditionally, it's always been like a movie or a TV series. A couple of times we did it as a comic book, so we would describe things panel by panel, kind of stuff like this.
Oh, yeah.
And I thought, you know what, as a bit of a twist, what if we actually did it more like a radio drama? And so, you know, that's one of the aspects that's in the game. You establish that in your session zero. And all that simply means is how you describe how things are taking place. So there always has to be a way where somehow, you know, something has to have, it has to be more audio focused, you know? So if there was going to be a description of something that you would normally see, that's where there was supposed to be basically the narrator who was basically kind of reading the action out loud. And so you could just kind of present things in that particular way. By the same token, too, if you were to do it in the, you know, present the game as a novel being written at the table, then you could actually start getting into, well, what is the character thinking? That we can do, because that you're allowed to do. You know, like, give me a paragraph. And in this paragraph, you can get into what the character is thinking as they're looking around a room and trying to figure out which window to jump out of before the guy with the shotgun comes up behind them. Whereas when you're in an action film, you don't have that luxury. You have to basically, how do we see that the character is trying to frantically make a decision and doesn't know what to do? We cut to a close shot of their eyes as they kind of dart back and forth. And then we cut to a POV as the camera goes left to right, left to right, left to right between the two windows. And then suddenly the character makes a jump and he goes out the left window. So it's all about in the framing and everything that comes of it. Trying to do action as a radio drama was tough. You know?
Oh, I bet.
It's such a crutch to just be like, this is what we see. That's right. It's not a thing that we're supposed to be able to see. What do we hear? We hear the sound of gunshots. We hear the sound of glass shattering. We hear the heavy panting of breathing and the footsteps that are running down the hall until all of a sudden we hear the Wilhelm scream and then splash in the water. Mm. You know? So, yeah, it's a very visual medium in some way, shape, or form. Where even like horror, which we talked about last time, horror has visual elements to it, but at the same time, too, really good horror makes excellent use of sound. Not just music, but sound effects and everything else like that. So, yeah, whereas action is very, very visual. So it's a lot of what do we see? What is the thing that we see that is going on in the environment around us? The environment, the situation, the setting is also a huge part of it. One of the things that the John Wick films are very good at doing is establishing the surrounding area so that if a character suddenly picks up something and uses it as a weapon, you've already established that it's there.
Right.
You know, it's not just, where did that come from? It's just like, that's right. Yeah, like at the end of The Raid 2, the fact that the fight takes place in a kitchen, like the best fucking fight scene ever.
It's placed
in a professional kitchen. And so it's just like any weapons that they pull out are weapons that you would expect to see in a kitchen, which include, you know, like steak knives and all this other kind of stuff.
Right.
And yeah, like its setting is also a huge part of it. Being able to frame the room that they're in gives the players so much to work off of to then draw from that when they are no longer, it's just like, damn, we can't go out that door. Well, this is the kitchen, right? Well, then let's just go out to the restaurant. There's going to be that kind of sliding doors that go out to the restaurant. The hell with it. Let's just run out to the restaurant. We'll try and escape that way. You know, kind of stuff like that. Yeah.
I've been pondering the whole time you were talking. This brings up an interesting thing that we might talk about in an episode. Because when I was taking a writing program, when I did writing workshop, Odyssey, fantastic, if anybody can go, I spent 6 weeks learning about writing and stuff. And one of the things that we did was taking an object and writing about it to evoke certain things, right?
Mm.
This is something that you can do in your role-playing games, What might be an interesting topic is how do we frame a scene we're narrating to our players for get different effects, right? They're going into a kitchen. How would I frame this if this is an action RPG? How do I frame this if this is like a political intrigue RPG? How do I frame this if it's a horror RPG? Because what I've realized talking about horror and action the past two ones is that it does have a lot to do with framing and how you present the information. So it might be interesting just to talk about and maybe do some exercises where we talk about, you know, a standard RP scene, you know, and talk about how can we frame this different ways? How would we narrate it as the DM to give different feelings, different atmospheres for whatever genre that we're playing? What do you think?
Oh, yeah. Oh, for sure. I'm a big believer in that in my GMing style. I have a practice that I like to call the opening shot, in that when a scene begins, my job is to basically give the opening shot of what we first see when the scene begins, with the premise of establishing who's what and where, how they got there, all this other kind of stuff. But more importantly, give them things to then draw from that they can kind of pull out of their own hats later on based on what's already been provided. Mm-hmm. And that is the thing where it's like, yeah, it's all about framing the scene. It's not about telling them everything that they need to know about this room. It's about telling them the key things that is important enough to know. It's just like, hey, so once again, like the kitchen fight scene at the end of Raid 2. This is the professional level kitchen. All right. That's all you need to tell them. You know, you can tell them it's just like, it's like all completely white tiled floors, white walls, stainless steel appliances, counters, everything like that. It is pristine, it is clean, and it is, you know, like it is absolute perfection in here. It doesn't look like there's a spot of dirt that's anywhere in here. So there's two things that that does. First of all, it establishes that this is the kitchen and therefore the kind of weapons that are available in this room. But what it also does is that as the scene progresses and reaches the conclusion, the contrast of the blood splattered all over everything
right,
really becomes that much more visceral because of what this room used to look like, you right. know? And that is a thing then as the scene continues, you can then as the GM, you start to kind of draw on that kind of stuff. It's like, remember right. how this used to be, like the floor here used to be like perfect white tiles. Now it is just smeared with the blood as you've been dragging his body across the floor. You right. know, the shards of glass as you basically smash your way through the window where the wine bottles are kept on the other side. You know, mm-hmm. the dent that's in the side of the counter, the stainless steel counter and everything right. else like that. You know, it's so, yeah, that framing, it's not about giving them all these specific details. It's about right. giving them just enough so that everyone can just be like, okay, well, if this is a kitchen, that means there's got to be this. That means there has right. to be here. You know, it also tells you what's not in the room. What's not in a kitchen? A toilet. You're not going to find a toilet in here. You need to go to another room if you want to find a toilet that's in this room. What do you need the toilet for? Well, I need a source of water.
There's a sink.
Yeah. Use the sink, you know, that makes sense, you know, kind of stuff like that. Right. So it gives you what is and what isn't in there in a very short period of time.
Right. You know, and framing it, you know, establishes all of that. But, yeah, you can also establish the atmosphere, you know, based on the type of game that you're playing. You know, you're going to describe it differently if you're like a horror and they're exploring a kitchen versus an action that's looking for fight stuff, you know. I don't know. I think it'd be interesting to have a discussion about that and like what tools you have when you're framing a scene. You know, how can you use what you're describing as smells and taste and whatever to evoke whatever atmosphere you're trying to evoke? And I think that has a lot to do with the vibe that you get from your game. So, you know, you can frame a lot of things so it feels like an action movie if you frame it the right way and describe it the right way, I think. you know, the mechanics and the type of game help. But I really do think, ever talking about The Last, that, you know, you can do a lot with how you as the game master frame this scene. You know, you as the one running the game. But to no one's surprise, we have gone over.
Yes, we have not been refining our timeliness during this little break. By no means whatsoever. If anything, we're trying to make up for lost time. I think exactly. We should just establish this is now a 75-minute podcast.
You know, it kind of is anyway.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, that could be interesting. I mean, do you have any last things about action games and trying, you know, any last thought on that?
Ironically enough, we have not actually touched on violence actually in an action game, because in a sense, I mean, action is basically predicated on the, you know, violence in some way, shape, or form. Even if it's just a car chase, there is still the potential of somebody getting injured. That in itself is violence. So that we don't turn into a 90-minute podcast, unless that's already too late. I think it's one of those things where it's important from the very beginning to whatever the action game it is that you're going to be playing, your session zero should be to establish the depths of the violence that's going to be involved. Mm-hmm. Is it going to be gruesome? Is it going to be PG-13? Is it going to be R-rated? You know, will there be limbs lost? Will characters lose teeth? You know, or is it basically just like, you know, you punch somebody and it doesn't leave a mark, you know, and, you know, that kind of stuff. Establishing,
you know, a little bloody nose and that's it.
Yeah, exactly. Like, that kind of thing like that, you know, but eventually people get up and walk away, you know, or, you know, like, is it one of those things where you could get shot, you know, do it like 1990s Hong Kong, you know, gangster style films where it's just like, you get shot 7 times, no biggie. You keep going, you know, you get shot in the shoulder and your arm is bloody, but you're still able to shoot with it. Or if a bullet hits you in the arm, do you lose the use of that arm? You know, so the level of greediness, you know, like, or goofiness that comes with the violence, I think is something that's also very important to establish, if not possibly one of the most important, because that's a safety tool, really, in an essence. You want to make sure everyone's on the same page as far as, like, you know, just how gritty are you getting with the violence, if at all?
Right. Right. Yeah. No, good call. Good call for sure. I mean, and actually, we could have a whole episode, of course, on violence in the games and how do you depict that? And, like, what are your options? And, mm-hmm. you know, like, we could have a whole episode on talking about those things, you know, how you describe stuff. What are your options? What are the levels? What are, you know, any of that stuff. So, yeah,
you know,
that's another thing that we could talk about.
If we do, I can't help but feel that we have to talk about The Tower, which is the one that I worked on that I have actually never spoken publicly about.
Oh, first time. You heard it here, everybody.
Yeah. But as time's been going on, I've really been debating. It's just like, I don't think I want to not talk about it anymore for numerous reasons. So if we do, because that is a game that is about using violence to preach against violence, mm-hmm. in a bizarre way.
Right.
So yeah, so if we do end up going into that topic, I feel it behooves me to actually then start saying, fuck it, I'm going to talk about it anyway.
Yeah, indeed.
And it just ripped the Band-Aid off and just, you know, basically just open the doors open wide and just be like, nuts to it. This is what it's about. And if your jaw drops, your jaw drops. I don't care anymore.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Exactly. Cool. No, and yeah, I mean, we just got, kind of generated a couple new topics for episodes, so.
That's what we do. That's what we do. We haven't missed a beat, everybody.
Yeah. Yeah, you know what would also be a fun episode to tangent a little bit more is take, you know, like RPG horror stories and, you know, conundrums and see how we would handle them and, you know, what we think the problem is there, you know, perhaps, and discuss.
Yes. Yes. That's
because I was actually just discussing a similar thing with my husband last night, where I watched a video of a call a GM made, Matt Mercer from Critical Role, and there was commentary in the comments, like discussing this particular conundrum of how do you handle that as a GM? And the basic premise was this character was giving a cupcake to a hag, and the cupcake got eaten by the hag, by Matt Mercer kind of DM'd that the hag takes the cupcake and eats it. And then the character says that, oh, that cake was dusted with dust of deliciousness, which lowers their wisdom. So now I can do this spell and it has a good chance of working. And so the conundrum was basically like, well, now you're just trying to trick the DM. Like you should have had to do a sleight of hand roll or a deception or something like that, instead of just having the thing happen and then saying, oh, by the way, you know, this was what I did, you know?
Yeah.
And people were in the audience discussing, and pretty helpfully in some instances, of, do you let the DM on things like that? You know, how do you handle that? You know, as a DM, if somebody does it to you, you know, that sort of thing. But that's the sort of stuff we can discuss, you know, RPG conundrums, you know, and how we might handle it.
Or mistakes that we made, you know, like as young GMs, you know, and how we would handle them now, you know, how the older and wiser versions of us would have handled them now if we were to.
I have a couple stories for that.
I have burned many a campaign to get to where I am right now. I have upset many a player to finally get to the point where it's just like, no, I think I get this now. I think I finally get it.
Nice. Well, for anyone listening, all our listeners, if that interests any of you, let us know. Let us know about your action RPGs. How do you do it? What ones do you like, if we didn't mention it? If you play one of the ones we recommended, what did you think of it? You know, let us know anything. So, yeah,
and if you also feel that High Plains Samurai is the only action RPG that anyone really should be playing,
definitely let Todd know.
Yeah, exactly. Because it would be nice to have a second opinion, actually.
Exactly. But anyway, until the next time, we wish you a little gaming in your magic and a little magic in your gaming.
The Covenstead Podcast was created and produced by Danielle Delisle and Todd Crapper. Theme music written and composed by John Thompson from the Rook and Rask channel on Twitch. Definitely check them out. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.